With great podcast comes great responsibility, so luckily we have nothing to worry about. It's Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me, as always, is a guy trying to balance his personal life with his life as a superhero.
Mike DiCrescio.
How you doing today, Mike?
It's going well. The balance, precarious at best.
It's a never-ending struggle.
Yeah, but it's a burden I have to bear.
Yeah, with great power comes great responsibility. That was exactly the catchphrase of old Uncle Ben. If you missed it, don't worry. He's going to say the line again and again and again.
Forever for the whole series.
If you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news, and then we move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately. And then after that, we will move on into our featured review. This week, it is the newest film from director John Watts, the sixth film in the Spider-Man franchise, but the first to take place in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, of which this is the 16th film. Spider-Man Homecoming. Mike, are you excited to dig into Spider-Man?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's been a long time coming, and it's happening now.
Yes, it is very exciting. I remember discovering for the first time that Sony and Marvel had merged forces and were bringing Spider-Man back into the fold of the Marvel Universe. We actually talked about it on this podcast a while back. I went back and found the old episode where we talked about it. It was episode 3 of this podcast. Yeah, it was in our review of Kingsman.
The distant past.
The not too distant past. It was pretty wild.
Were we freaking out? I think we were.
I think we were probably freaking out on the inside, but I feel like we were either so burned out from school or hungover or something. We seemed very.
That doesn't seem like us. That would have never happened.
We seemed very lax, is what I'm saying. I think we didn't have the energy back then that we do now. We've improved very much as podcasters. If I may say so myself.
We got stronger as we got older.
Exactly.
That happened.
Wisdom and stuff. We're going to talk about Spider-Man Homecoming a lot, I am sure. But before we get into that, we should get into some film news. It's time for film news here on Film Bookcast, and it's going to be a pretty short film news section today because, honestly, there just hasn't been that much film news over the past few days. I'm sure there's been, like, minor stuff here and there, but nothing major, nothing hard-pressing. Plus, we recorded an episode just a few days ago, Baby Driver, which you can go find on filmbook.com. So there hasn't been that much time for stories to accumulate, but there are a couple things I wanted to mention. It looks like Daniel Craig is going to be back as James Bond for Bond 25. So, told you so, internet. That's
yep.
Have I not been saying that for years now at this point, Mike?
But, Mike, he would rather slash his wrists than do another movie.
Yeah, well, he was on a contract, Mike, and nobody seems to remember that. I
That's not how movies work. Or contracts.
Yeah, it was a weird thing. So, I mean, you know, Daniel Craig, I believe it was reported after Skyfall came out that he was contracted to do at least two more movies. And then Spectre was coming out, and they were doing the press tour, and Daniel Craig said something to the effect of, I would rather slash my own wrists than be in another James Bond movie, which seems like, you know, not a great way to publicize your new movie, but whatever.
Maybe not the best messaging, but, you know.
Certainly not the worst, I guess.
He didn't say not to see the movie, so.
Yeah, so there's that. But, yeah, and when that happened, you know, and there was a lot of rumors going around that Daniel Craig might not return for the next one, and people just started assuming it as fact that Daniel Craig was not coming back for James Bond 25. And I would have to correct people over and over again. I'm positive he has another movie on his contract. I kept telling them. until eventually I started doubting myself.
That we gaslit you, Mike.
Yeah, exactly. And so then the rumors started flying about who could replace Daniel Craig in the next one. You know, Idris Elba, Tom Hiddleston was floated around. You remember that? We talked about that on this podcast a while back. And now that can all be put to rest. Daniel Craig is almost definitely coming back for James Bond 25. And that's great. I think that's a good thing. I mean, I liked Spectre more than most people, but it was one of his more underwhelming Bond efforts. We should say. And I think, you know, this is his chance to go out on a really high note.
Yeah. If they could somehow recreate the wonder that we all felt for Skyfall,
Casino Royale.
Yeah, that'd be a nice note for him to end on. Absolutely. Pass the torch to someone else.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it could do a lot of great things with Christoph Waltz's Blofeld as well, because they left him alive at the end of Spectre, and I always assumed they were building him up to return in some capacity. And so I think, you know, Spectre sets up a really great finale for the Daniel Craig Bond series. And so I hope that Bond 25 is good. And it's possible, and this one is a little more up in the air, but it's possible that Adele may return to perform the theme song for this movie, which I think would be great, because the Skyfall theme is one of the best ones.
Yeah, definitely the one that probably sold the most, I assume. Yeah. Or at least in the modern era. I don't know.
It was the first Bond theme to ever win an Oscar for Best Original Song.
Right.
And then the next one also won, Writings on the Wall, which many would argue was not as deserving a winner as, as the Skyfall theme was. But yeah, so it's cool that Adele might come back for this thing. And like, I'm not like anti-Adele or anything, but I'm not the hugest fan of her music, but I really love the Skyfall theme song. And so I'm eager to see her return to the Bond franchise. There's only been a couple of artists who have done more than one Bond theme song. I think, what was her name? Whoever sang the Goldfinger theme song. I can't remember. I'm blanking on it now. I mean, I hate myself in the morning for for forgetting this. But I know she sang Goldfinger, and she sang, I think, For Your Eyes Only, something like that. She did a couple of them. And so it would be cool for Adele to join such esteemed company as Shirley What's-Her-Name.
Oh, man.
I'm going to hate myself tomorrow for not remembering that.
Shirley Bassey.
Shirley Bassey. That was it. I knew it. That's the one. I said it.
You were close. You were in the ballpark.
Shirley. Yeah, I had Shirley. Anyway, so yeah, I wanted to bring that up just to prove to the internet that I was right, that Daniel Craig was coming back.
Not that important, but we wanted to make sure everyone knew.
Just wanted to make sure everyone knew that I told you so. And then finally, I have one last bit of film news, too. It looks like Samuel L. Jackson will be reprising the role of Nick Fury in Captain Marvel. Marvel's Captain Marvel movie starring Brie Larson as Captain Marvel. Actually, switcheroo, Samuel L. Jackson's playing Captain Marvel. And Brie Larson's playing Nick Fury. It's a body
swap. It's going to shake up the whole yeah, phase.
It's going to be nuts. You know how like Marvel tends to, you know, choose a different genre for each superhero movie they do? This one is body swap comedy.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I'm in. I'm so down.
It's going to be awesome. There'll be a scene with Samuel L. Jackson and Brie Larson hanging out by a fountain while Freaky Friday is playing on a TV behind them.
Yep.
It's going to be great. Samuel Jackson is playing Nick Fury in Captain Marvel. And I don't think this is huge news anymore, but since this is kind of a slow news week, I'm throwing this in here anyway. And it's just kind of more evidence of Marvel just having some fun mixing and matching heroes for a while now. You know, like, I mean, we're talking about Spider-Man Homecoming today, and Iron Man plays a pretty significant part in that movie. So there's that. And Hulk is going to be in Thor Ragnarok, and Falcon showed up in Ant-Man, and almost the entire Avengers roster was in Captain America Civil War, and literally everyone who has ever been in a movie is going to be in Avengers Infinity War.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
It's going to be Avengers Infinity War will probably employ almost everyone in the United States except for the two of us. I believe that's...
Yeah. Just about.
Just because we can't get jobs. That's all it is. Anyway, yeah, so I think that's pretty cool, though. Samuel Jackson coming back as Nick Fury. He hasn't really been in any of these movies in a couple of years.
Yeah, I think that's the kind of joy of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. We talk about it every time we talk about their movies. But, like, this kind of, like, it's what the comic books universe is anyway, right? That everyone is in New York, and so people pop in and out. Doctor Strange is in the comic books and stuff, and now we're going to have that in the movies, where, sure, Thor and Hulk end up on the same planet or wherever Thor is.
Yeah, like, why not?
Yeah, so who it's going to be silly ensemble cast times for the rest of the MCU.
Yeah, which I'm all about. I think it's a really cool thing. So,
yeah,
absolutely. So wanted to mention that briefly because it was a slow news week.
When have we ever given up an opportunity to talk about more Marvel?
Also true. I mean, we're going to be talking a lot about Marvel today, but we can always talk about more. So... But before we get into our Spider-Man interview, Mike, let's move on into our discussion. Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions. All right, it's time for discussions here on Film Bookcast. Mike, what do you have to discuss with us today?
This week, I have two things to discuss. Two, I know. I'm ahead of the curve, Mike. I did homework for once. One of which is the new animated series just released on Netflix called Castlevania, of course, based on the historic video game franchise from 1980-something.
Through to, like, they're still making Castlevania games, right? Like, they're still happen?
Yeah, there are definitely recent Castlevania games. I don't remember when the most recent one came out, but it's still a pretty active franchise.
Okay.
Yeah, so Netflix got the rights. They got Warren Ellis, a storied comic book writer.
Right.
I think he's also written novels and stuff, but a pretty famed writer to write the series. And the season for the season is only 4 episodes, so it's a little weird, but it's kind of great because it's only, you know, an hour and 50 minutes or so. There are 25 minutes each.
It's the equivalent of watching a movie, basically.
Yeah, like, pretty much.
In terms of running time.
Yeah, which I have some opinions on, but it's still really cool. The art and the animation for it is beautiful, which is really odd. It's kind of done in like an anime, Japanese animation style. But it is incredibly gory, like R-rated, like hard R. There's a lot of cursing. It's very mature. It deals with religion and hypocrisy. I mean, and that's kind of what Castlevania is about anyway. It's people that don't know the video game. You follow the Belmont family, which is kind of like a Van Helsing type family. They are monster and vampire hunters.
Right.
Trying to fight their way into Dracula's castle, basically, in the first game. And it's kind of what this...
This is unrelated, but is the Belmont Stakes a pun on the Belmont Fighting Vampires family?
I don't think it is now. It is in my mind forever. God damn it. I wonder if they made that. That can't possibly be real. That's amazing. But yeah, so it deals with, you know, religion, and it takes place in the 1400s, I think. So like kind of the dark Middle Ages. But so yeah, really hard R. There's lots of demons tearing people's faces and eyes and guts, like approaching Event Horizon stuff.
Nice.
Where Sam Neill's going to hold his eyeballs out to the camera. but it's really cool. It is interesting to see that kind of like really beautiful animation style be exploited in such a way to show how a body exploding looks. It's really weird.
Right.
But so it's only 4 episodes and about 2 hours, like I said. And I think, I can't remember if it was the day it premiered or the day after it premiered, they immediately greenlit an 8-episode season 2.
Okay.
Which is kind of leading me more towards the, like we mentioned with Sense8, where it feels sort of like Netflix has these plans already, and then they drop the thing to make people want it, and then they give them what the thing they had planned already. Like I mentioned it with Sense8, with the canceling it and then immediately announcing the finale wrap-up episode.
Right. They got enough time to get people upset, and then as soon as they got upset and like started writing letters and stuff, they threw out, oh, we're doing a finale episode. Like
yeah. So, which is whatever. It's just a cool marketing thing, I guess, they're doing, or PR stuff.
Right.
But it definitely, and these 4 episodes definitely feel like a prologue in the way it ramps up in the very last episode. It's still cool. It's a cool, if you view it as a 2-hour movie, basically, it's a cool experience. So definitely people should check it out. And then after watching that, I was kind of in a gothic monster movie mode, and I scrolled through Netflix and I found a movie that's on my 80s-a-palooza list, or whatever I called it that time.
I completely forget what it was, yeah.
Yeah, something. I think I said D&D-a-palooza the first time by accident,
maybe.
Like always.
It's just always in your mind, the D&D.
Oh, forever. I found American Werewolf in London.
All right.
The 1981 movie, I believe, directed and written by John Landis.
Now, you had never seen this before?
So I thought I had. This is the thing. Like, I remember staying up late on HBO in middle school or something like that and watching a movie that had an American Werewolf in the title.
Right.
It turns out I had watched American Werewolf in Paris. Who knew that was even a thing? So there's a 1995 or 6 or something
97,
sequel.
97, I think, yeah.
97 sequel, also written and directed by John Landis, I believe. But that's not the movie we're talking about. We're talking about American Werewolf in London, the incredibly silly, incredibly gory also monster movie. That's a, I mean, it's in the title.
There it is.
That's all right. Tells you everything you need to know about two American backpackers that get viciously attacked. One survives, viciously attacked by a werewolf. One survives and becomes a werewolf. And it's pretty great. It's hysterical for a lot of its runtime. I mean, it's not, it's, I'm not saying original things. I think most people have either heard of or have seen this movie by now.
Right.
But I, from my understanding, it enjoyed a pretty cult, or I guess still does enjoy a cult standing for a lot of people.
Yeah, no, it's a really great movie. I haven't seen it. I saw it once a few years ago, and I would like to rewatch it again because it's been a while. But I remember loving it.
Definitely a super recommend. Features incredible practical effects and animatronics. There's the climax or the third act of the movie starts or takes place. There's a very funny conversation between the main character, his friend who's a corpse, and then all of a couple other dead people in an adult theater.
Just
they're having this really deep philosophical conversation about what it means to be a monster while there's just a porno playing, like, projected in the theater. And it's hilarious. Silly John Landis goodness. So, yeah, check it out. That's definitely a good movie to watch.
Nice. American Werewolf in London. One of Edgar Wright's favorite movies also.
I could believe it. I can't remember. There is a moment like where a really weird transition happens. Well, maybe not weird, but like where an object on the screen moves by and it does like a wipe transition.
Yeah.
That was like, that's straight out of Edgar Wright's movies. Like, that's where he got that, maybe.
Nice. That's American Werewolf in London and Castlevania. Both of them are on Netflix. And then I have my discussions. Obviously, I'm talking about Twin Peaks because I...
Clearly.
Because this is my Twin Peaks discussion thread until the season ends. Episode 9 just aired last night. And you caught up on Twin Peaks up until episode 8, right? You watched episode 8 recently?
Yes. Yeah, I got up to episode 8. I didn't get to watch last night's episode 9. But, man.
Dude.
Just what?
It's just... bananas, right?
yeah. I can't remember. I think I've mentioned it. I can't remember if I mentioned it to you on the show while we were recording it. But I definitely this season. I don't mean to take your discussion, but
I want you to participate
to discuss.
Yeah,
I have been mentioning or I have talked about that it feels a lot like David Lynch's early like student film shorts.
Yeah,
and particularly episode 8. Is kind of just straight out of that.
Yeah.
The back half of episode 8.
Like the last 45 minutes, really, of episode 8. Because
it wasn't really that long. Yeah, I think it was. Yeah.
I had my most successful tweet ever because of that episode of Twin Peaks. I got like 75 retweets and like 110 likes or something on this one
tweet.
You're
so vain, Mike.
Like, I mean, not that anyone's counting. but I said that, I said, we interrupt this episode of Twin Peaks to bring you a Nine Inch Nails concert followed by the craziest shit you've ever seen. And I didn't realize how apt that was a description of the episode, but apparently the internet agreed with me. Cause it's like 10 minutes at the beginning of like Dark Cooper. I'm going to spoil, like you've seen it now, so I can spoil things and it's fine.
Yeah.
It's like, the Dark Cooper, the Cooper Ganger, the Doppel Cooper.
Cooper Ganger.
And his cohort, I think his name is Ray, driving. And they're just driving and it's, you know, dark and it's quiet and they're just driving for a really long time. And then they get out of the car and then Ray shoots the Cooper Ganger and then these like weird fucking monsters like come out and just start like excavating Cooper Ganger's body.
Yeah. Yep.
And then it cuts away from that to the Bang Bang Bar where the Nine Inch Nails are playing.
Yeah.
We go through a full song from the Nine Inch Nails. It's like a 5-minute performance. Sure. And it's awesome. And then from there we flash back to 1945 and the first detonation of an atomic bomb in the US.
As one does.
Yeah. And then it becomes this insane experimental short, essentially, but within the Twin Peaks mythos. And it's bananas, and there's a whole lot of different interpretations about what everything in that short means. Generally speaking, it's people seem to agree that it's about the creation of Bob, but also the possibly the creation of Laura Palmer. And there's so much stuff. It's really, it's a sensory experience unlike anything else I've seen on TV, possibly ever, but at least in a very, very long time. Definitely ever, I will say.
Yeah, it manages to just be, really. Like, it is just raw, like, avant-garde David Lynch experimenting with what he can do and the medium of lights and sounds that are television and film, just, like, making shit.
Yeah.
And that for 45 minutes.
Yeah, and should be, I want to note specifically the sound design, because the sound design is intense and horrifying, and that's all, like, if you look at the credits, sound design by David Lynch. Like, it's not, like, a sound engineer or anything. It's Lynch himself.
I'm not surprised.
And it's some of the best stuff. Like, he's been working, like, as a musician for the past several years, and so I feel like that expertise is kind of coming back around for this. And it's just really insane. So episode 8 is truly one of the most bogus episodes of TV I've ever seen. Episode 9 is a much more back-to-basics Twin Peaks after the insanity of episode 8. Still very compelling, and it gives us a lot of great material featuring Bobby Briggs, who has only been in one episode before this, but he made a big impression in that episode, I think. That was one of my favorite parts of the show at this point. And so now, episode 9 is now the halfway point of the season. There are 18 episodes total. And I think it's safe to say the show isn't anywhere close to what anyone expected it was going to be.
No, which is, man, I'm very conflicted about it in general. Like, really? It's great. It's really wild and hard to wrap your head around, which Twin Peaks kind of always was.
Right.
Well, okay. I'm developing new opinions, because the original Twin Peaks kind of ushered in the new era of television, right? The procedural primetime cop drama.
Right. And then serialized, it had the serialized story and everything and all that stuff. Yeah.
And it kind of feels like, I don't want to say masturbatory in some way, like the stuff that David Lynch is doing in this new season, but it feels kind of him just being like, yeah, motherfuckers, this is what's up. We're going to do it again. I'm going to reinvent TV a second time.
That's the thing. I feel like you're saying that's almost negative, but I really think this is like a groundbreaking season of TV. Like,
yeah, the first half of that thought definitely started negative, but then as I kind of I shifted back to positive. But for a while there, like maybe episodes 5, 6, and 7, like it's cool stuff. There's really interesting, weird things happening, but it felt like we weren't really going anywhere, and I don't know that we necessarily need to in Twin Peaks, right? But they're kind of that first season and the first half of season 2 were doing this weird experimental David Lynch stuff, but primarily driven by the mystery of who killed Laura Palmer.
Right.
And we have kind of no driving mystery yet, a little bit.
I think we have driving mystery. It's not really a driving mystery, but I think our investment is supposed to be in Cooper returning back to his normal self.
Right.
And I think that's part of what has driven a lot of people away from this. I think this has been a very difficult show for certain fans of the original Twin Peaks, who maybe aren't as familiar with Dave Lynch's work outside of that TV show.
Right.
Because I think what a lot of people might have expected from this, and what you tend to expect from a lot of these like reunion shows, or like, you know, revival seasons or what have you,
right,
is kind of like a trip down memory lane, like a nostalgia-driven season. And I feel like David Lynch has no interest in that at all.
No.
And I'm thrilled about that. Like, this is a new and exciting thing. Like, there are cast members of the original show. We're 9 episodes in. We're halfway through the season. There are cast members from the original show who I thought would have a significant part in this new show. Like, they're in the cast list. Like, I know they're going to show up at some point. They haven't shown up at all.
Or have shown up for 2 minutes of screen time, like Bobby Briggs.
I mean, Bobby Briggs had more to do in this most recent episode, actually. But James showed up in episode 1. Haven't seen him since, you know?
But he was always so cool, Mike.
He was always so cool. And, I'm thrilled every time I see one of those original characters, like one of those original cast members, one of those original characters. But at the same time, I feel like I am so invested in the new stuff that's happening. And there's so much new stuff happening that, like, I feel like I'm thrown in all these different directions, to the point where I can't even just focus on the original characters. I feel like it's taking time away from the actual mysteries that it's happening right now. because the narrative behind this season has been mostly surrounding the two Kyle MacLachlans, two Coopers, doing his two different things. So there's the Dougie Jones stuff, and there's the Cooper Ganger stuff, and then there's Gordon Cole and Albert's. With Diane in tow, by the way, which is awesome.
Yeah.
With Laura Dern, which
that
is
was
great.
Awesome.
And like they're investigating the whole thing. Meanwhile, you do have the action going back at Twin Peaks with Robert Forster as the new Sheriff Truman and Hawk kind of leading an investigation of their own into what's going on with Cooper. And so there are a lot of different stuff going on, and there are familiar characters, but they're not the characters that I feel like you would have expected would be leading a new Twin Peaks show, you know?
Right.
Like, you have Kyle MacLachlan doing his thing, but he's not playing the Cooper that you know and love.
Not at all.
Not at all.
He's playing Dougie Jones.
I honestly think, like, we won't see that until the very end of the season.
I totally believe it at this point.
Yeah. And it'd be great to see him back as Cooper, you know, traditional Cooper, you know, by before then. But I also don't think, like, from what everything Cooper has gone through, I don't think he would be the same character he would have been 25 years ago. You know, like, I feel like spending 25 years in the Red Room might change a person, you know?
I do want to shout out my favorite tiny this season especially has been doing these tiny little like weird character arcs for extras in the strung out mom that was across the street from the house that Dougie and I can't remember the prostitute's name, but that they were in,
Jade.
Like that part, Jade, yes.
Nice. I remember that because the Jade Give Two Rides line was very funny.
This show is still hysterical, and this is where this is going. The coworker at the office where Dougie works, and he has to drink the green tea latte because Dougie steals his coffee. And it's like we take a minute to pause and watch him consider the green tea latte, and then like, oh, no, give in. He, you know,
yeah,
and then it's like, oh, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. He like really likes it.
Green tea latte.
Yeah. It's so fucking weird.
Yeah,
I just wanted to call that out.
Yeah, I mean, I love Twin Peaks. It's kind of insane to be able to tune in every week to a TV show with literally no clue about what to expect of the show from like week to week. It's kind of amazing. And there's no like there's no previews for the next episode either. There's no next time on Twin Peaks.
Right.
So you don't even have like a glimpse of what's to come. You just like are stone cold going in for these new episodes. And it's pretty great. It's just really satisfying. And I think, you know, I really feel like David Lynch is like changing TV again in a pretty big way. Cause I feel like after episode 8 aired, like imagine everybody who's ever wanted to do something that insane on TV, looking at that and being like, that can be done. That can be a thing. A network will pay for that. You know,
you have to be David Lynch, but it could be a thing.
But I think there are other people who could conceivably get away with that, especially now that David Lynch has kind of like broken the mold with that. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like if Damon Lindelof wanted to do that, like something along those lines, I feel like he could pull it off. Somebody like him or
you
would probably have to be a pretty major, TV show in order to get that, to make that happen. But, I think it will ultimately have an effect on the stuff that we see on TV. So that's pretty cool. And you know what else is a pretty cool experimental show that's aired?
I'm so curious.
Just brought its second season back. Maybe not quite in the same vein as Twin Peaks. Master of None season 2. Which is my other discussion for today.
Oh, man.
Season 2 of Master of None hit Netflix in May. I finally got around to starting watching it, and I loved season 1. Season 1 was incredible. Aziz Ansari and Alan Yang's great Netflix comedy. It has returned, still firing on all cylinders. I have now watched 7 of the 10 episodes that are in the season, and I came away really, truly impressed at what the show is capable of each time. I mean, the show has gotten much more experimental in terms of what it's willing to do, and the first season had that. Like, it did, you know, certain episodes where it would do a whole episode that's just Aziz Ansari and his girlfriend in Nashville, or there was one episode in season 1 that was the entirety of their relationship over the span of like 6 months, and it was like just them in their apartment, seeing how their relationship changes in just that apartment, and that was a very cool episode. But it's got even more so. For example, the first episode of the season is a full-length homage to Italian neorealism films of the 40s and 50s. So it's in black and white. A lot of it is in Italian. Specifically, it's referencing the movie Bicycle Thieves, which is a movie I love. So I was like all in. And it's really, really great. I think my favorite episode thus far has been episode 4, which just captures the grind of dating through apps like Tinder so perfectly that it is terrifying. It's just a very funny show. It's very nuanced and very honest. And I think Aziz Ansari is one of my favorite comedians, and he does really great work here. So Master of None Season 2, available on Netflix right now. Hopefully Season 3 happens. Aziz Ansari has been saying that the show might be done just because he doesn't know what else he can do with it.
Which is fair.
Yeah, but he said because a lot of it's based on his own life experiences. And I think he thinks he's out of life experiences, I guess, or not enough to fill a season three anyway. So he might want to wait a few years and then come back. So we'll see what happens. I'm hoping season three does happen at some point. But season two of Master of None is really great. And season one is as well. Have you watched any Master of None, Mike?
No, it's just another one of those shows that I've heard a lot about. I have never heard a bad thing about.
Right.
But just haven't hit play yet. I don't know why.
Yeah, fair enough. It's the era of peak TV, man.
Yeah, there's just too much.
Now it's the era of peaks TV.
God.
Good job. Yeah, but there is so much stuff. Like, it's actually, like, I feel like there's so much TV now that I'm actually watching less of it.
Because I'm overwhelmed. You don't have to watch everything to find more than enough. So, you know.
Yeah, so now I can stick to, like, you know, five or six shows and be, like, pretty good.
Yeah.
But yeah, speaking of peak TV, by the way, what were you going to say? I saw your finger go up.
I was going to say, Mike, we're about to enter a future starting next week where there is new Twin Peaks and new Game of Thrones on the same night.
I was about to say the same thing. That's what I was about to say. Yeah, Game of Thrones coming back next week, and it's airing at the same time as Twin Peaks, too. Which is going to cause a lot of conflict in my head. But obviously, I think Twin Peaks is going to win out for me. But but that's probably just me. But yeah, I'm excited for Game of Thrones, though. And that's going to be a show. It's going to mess up my sleep schedule because I'm going to want to watch Twin Peaks as soon as I can. But if Game of Thrones is airing at the same time, then I'm going to have to watch Game of Thrones immediately afterwards. Because if I don't, it will be spoiled for me the next morning. You know, it's just how it works with Game of Thrones. Anyway, so yeah, that's Twin Peaks, that's Master of None, and that's the preview for Game of Thrones, which I'm sure we'll talk about Game of Thrones at some point in these discussions as well. I think it's only like seven
mid-season.
What? Mid-season.
We'll check in mid-season. Yeah.
Well, that's what I was about to say, is I think the season's only like seven episodes, right?
I think so, yeah.
Like, so it's not really like a mid-season, we'd only have watched like three episodes of the show.
That's never stopped us before.
Yeah, fair enough. all right, so that's our discussion segment, Mike. Let's do it. Let's move on to our featured review of Spider-Man Homecoming.
What's up, guys? Wait a minute. You guys aren't the real Avengers. I can tell Hulk gives it away. Oh, that was awesome.
Is Liz the new top?
No, you've seen that before. Never with that skirt.
She probably stops staring before it gets creepy, though.
Too late. You guys are losers.
So, to become an Avenger, are there, like, trials or an interview?
Just don't do anything I would do. And definitely don't do anything I wouldn't do. There's a little gray area in there, and that's where you operate.
Oh.
All right?
That's not a hug. I'm just grabbing the door for you.
All right, kid. Good luck out there.
All right, that was from the trailer for Spider-Man Homecoming, the new film directed by John Watts. It stars Tom Holland, Michael Keaton, Jacob Batalon, Laura Harrier, Tony Revolori, Zendaya, Marissa Tomei, Jon Favreau, and Robert Downey Jr., among others. And the IMDb plot synopsis for Spider-Man Homecoming reads, Peter Parker, with the help of his mentor, Tony Stark, tries to balance his life as an ordinary high school student in New York City while fighting crime as his superhero alter ego Spider-Man when a new threat emerges.
Ooh.
It actually says ooh at the end of the
That's real weird.
Yeah, very strange.
We know how iffy IMDb is with their synopses.
So, Mike, Spider-Man is my absolute favorite superhero. I think I've talked about this before with you and on this podcast before. What is your relationship with Spider-Man, Mike?
Spider-Man, I've mentioned a bunch of times on here that I am relatively new to the actual books. I have kind of been, you know, they've always been a thing that I'm aware of and kind of wished I was into. So I've never particularly read any Spider-Man comics, but I love the character. He's one of those, like, character. I think just through cultural osmosis, everyone knows everything, or, you know, a lot of stuff about Spider-Man, a lot like Batman and Superman. He's one of those level characters, and Wolverine now. But I love the Spider-Gwen comics, which is an alternate universe Spider-Man take. Just it's Gwen Stacy got bit by the spider instead of Peter Parker.
Yes.
And it's fucking awesome, so people should read that.
The Spider-Gwen comics are really cool. I do enjoy those comics quite a bit. For my part, I mean, I used to watch the cartoon when I was a kid. When I was about 10, my middle school, I think, I guess I was 11, my middle school had the first, like, 15 volumes of Spider-Man comics in the library. So they were, like, these big, like, omnibus things that were, like, 20 issues apiece. And so I read, like, the first, like, 150 issues of Spider-Man.
Were they, like, the Stan Lee, the original?
Original Stan Lee, Steve Ditko Spider-Man comics. And so I was able to read that entire, like, Stan Lee wrote, I think, the first 120 issues of Spider-Man or something. And I read all of them, and I read a few more past that. So I think I read about the first, like, 150 or so issues of Spider-Man, which I just, like, devoured. And then when I got back into comics a couple years ago, the reason I did so was because they were relaunching Spider-Man. And, you know, they had a new number one, and so I was very excited about that, and I got really into that. And as you know, I got really into the Spider-Verse crossover that they did. And I haven't really read any comics in a while because that cost a lot of dollars. But if I ever do get back into comics, it will almost definitely be because of Spider-Man. And of course, I was raised on Sam Raimi's Spider-Man movies, to my mind, are among the greatest superhero movies ever made. And in the case of Spider-Man 2, you know, one of the best movies ever.
See last episode.
Yeah. I think that was actually two episodes ago.
Two episodes. Yeah, two episodes.
Yeah, I believe we said the Holy Trinity was The Great Train Robbery, Citizen Kane, Spider-Man 2.
There you go. Definitive points in cinema history.
Exactly. It's just those are the three. If you were only ever going to watch three movies in your entire life, those would be the ones to watch.
I mean, we're mostly joking, I think, but Spider-Man, Sam Raimi's Spider-Man, is a turning point in modern superhero blockbuster cinema.
Yeah, I think it's blockbuster cinema in general, but yeah, absolutely.
Between the Sam Raimi Spider-Man and the X-Men movies, they made superhero movies as we know them today viable.
Yes, that's very much true, yeah. And I remember being crushed when it was announced that Spider-Man 4 was canceled. I don't know. Do you remember when that happened? Like, do you remember where you were the day Spider-Man 4 was canceled?
I don't think I do.
Yeah, no, I was at home. I was reading it on my computer.
It was kind of like any other day.
Kind of like any other day. I believe I was in 11th grade, 10th or 11th grade. It was like 2010, I think. Yeah.
Oh, wait. Yeah, that does sound... Yes, okay.
Yeah, so I remember there was this... It was like a big thing. I was literally... I remember this very vividly. I was at home. It was maybe like 6:30. I was on the computer. I was on IGN.
In your Spider-Man pajamas.
Well, here's the thing. No, I was on IGN.com, and I clicked on an article that said, like, oh, Sam Raimi Spider-Man 4 is doing this thing. Like, there's a rumor that John Malkovich might be playing the Vulture. Like, that would be pretty wild. And, like, the script is gearing up. It's gearing up. And I was like, okay, cool. Spider-Man 4 update. It's very nice. And then I left the house for a couple hours to go to my drama club. And then I came back, and it was like 9 p.m., and I logged onto my computer. I went back on IGN.com and discovered, and like, it's just there's this big headline that says Spider-Man 4 canceled, reboot planned. And I was, and my jaw like dropped. And I remember reading that news and literally like running upstairs to wake my brother and tell him about it. Like it was a national tragedy.
You know, it's my favorite part of how that story is dated, that you were on IGN for breaking news. That's amazing.
That is pretty much what it was. So that resulted in the Amazing Spider-Man movies, the Mark Webb movies with Andrew Garfield, which are overall like not great, right? I think we can
pretty shaky.
Yeah, I think the first one does have its merits, but I think it just gets it so wrong on so many levels. And there are scenes in those movies that are good. And I've always maintained that, like, even though Andrew Garfield was miscast, I think Andrew Garfield was miscast in the role, but he and Emma Stone as Gwen Stacy, they're off the charts terrific. Like, they're amazing in those movies. And if those movies had been 90-minute romantic comedies with Spider-Man stuff in the background, like, I would love them. They'd be perfect. If they were, like, Before Sunrise and Before Sunset, but with Spider-Man stuff. Like, aces. I would love it. And instead, by the time we got to Amazing Spider-Man number two, we got like a very bloated attempt at building a universe where there was very little room for a universe to build.
Right.
You know? It's very difficult to build a universe when you only have access to one character.
And a bunch of tertiary villains.
Yeah, exactly. And so Sony was trying to do all these spinoffs, like they were trying to do the Venom movie and they were trying to do the Sinister Six movie. And wow, look how that's turning out.
Yeah, but we're going to get a Black Cat and Silver Sable movie.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean is that stuff's still in the works. The time is time is cyclical. But anyway, yeah, so all that stuff kind of collapsed in on itself. And now Sony has joined forces with Marvel to save the character and bring him into the wildly successful Marvel Cinematic Universe.
What a novel idea.
Which is insane, yeah. And we got our first taste of that, of Tom Holland as Spider-Man in Captain America Civil War. And now we see him in action in his own movie. And, you know, we were talking about this in the beginning of this podcast. I remember first getting the news that Marvel would be getting Spider-Man back, just being blown away by the possibilities that presented. And, you know, I was listening to our old podcast where we talked about it. That was during our Kingsman review. We talked about how Logan Lerman or Tyler James Williams could be a potential Spider-Man.
Right.
Tyler James Williams is Chris from Everybody Hates Chris, if anybody.
Yeah. That was when we didn't know if it was Miles Morales or...
Right. No, we didn't really know anything at the time.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so we really didn't have a ton to go on other than that he would be in a Marvel movie, and we assumed that it would be Civil War.
Right.
But they hadn't even announced that yet. We just assumed Civil War because that's the one with all the superheroes in it. it was either going to be that or Doctor Strange, and it wasn't going to be Doctor Strange.
You don't know. It could have been.
Yeah. I also, in that episode, devised a very elaborate plan to bring Tobey Maguire back into the role. I don't know if you remember that.
I don't. I'm so interested, though.
So my what I said in that episode was because we were assuming that Spider-Man would make his appearance in Captain America Civil War, was that, you know, Spider-Man probably wouldn't have that big of a role in the movie, right? Because Civil War had already started filming, I think, at that point. And so
right.
We figured, you know, they'll throw Spider-Man in for like a couple of like extra tertiary scenes or whatever, but he will never take his mask off throughout the movie, right?
Right.
And because the iconic scene in the Civil War comic is Spider-Man taking his mask off and revealing to the world that he's Peter Parker. And so I was thinking, well, what if, you know, he's in the movie, he's doing his thing, he's Spider-Manning around, but you never see him with his mask off. He's just in there throwing quips and stuff. And you're like, oh man, I'm really enjoying Spider-Man in this movie. And then at the very end, he's at a press conference, he takes off his mask and it's Tobey Maguire.
Oh my God.
And they just usher Sam Raimi's movies into the Marvel Cinematic Universe was my,
that would have been amazing.
Was my thought process. That ended up not happening.
What a twist.
Instead, we have Tom Holland as Spider-Man. So, Mike, now we've gotten all that out of the way. Well, first, let's recap a little bit, even more so. Captain America Civil War. We both liked that movie quite a bit. What did you think of Spider-Man in that movie?
I think I remember echoing Jeff Cannata from the Slash Filmcast, where he called Spider-Man's portrayal in Civil War the best Spider-Man movie. I mean, we just talked about Spider-Man 2 as the best Spider-Man movie, but I think it was the one where they finally got it right in the most Marvel-y way. I don't know how else to put that.
Yeah, I've been seeing that sentiment a lot, that Tom Holland is easily the best on-screen Spider-Man, that he's the one who most represents what the character is like in the comics. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think he's very good in the role. I like him a lot, but in my heart, he can't be Toby,
It's your boy Toby.
Toby. Yeah, I feel like Tobey Maguire brings this earnestness and emotional intensity to those movies that Tom Holland doesn't really have yet. I mean, Tom Holland's definitely earnest in the role, but I guess there's an emotional gravitas to Tobey Maguire's performance in those movies that, you know, I don't think a 15-year-old kid can't really do yet, you know?
Yeah.
Or he's actually 21, but
right, that's what I was gonna ask. Do you happen to know how old your boy Toby was
Toby was pushing 30, like.
Okay, yeah, so there's a little difference.
Yeah,
I just wasn't sure. I didn't know.
Yeah. No, I think Andrew Garfield was 27 when he first got Spider-Man, and Toby was definitely pushing 30. But again, Toby is he's only in high school for like the first half hour of the original Spider-Man movie, and then that's
right. That's cool. Yeah, he's definitely an older.
Yeah, so I mean, he's like, I think in Spider-Man 2 he's in college. I think in Spider-Man 3 he's also in college. So he's definitely like, he's supposed to be playing younger, even though he is much older than whatever the character was supposed to be. But you know, I still think he's great in the role. Andrew Garfield does look younger than Tobey Maguire, and yeah, he was 27 when he was first cast. He still looks too old to be in high school.
Yeah.
And at least in those movies, he's in high school for both movies.
Is he? I remember the plot of the second one is trying to get into Oxford or some crap, right?
I think Gwen Stacy gets into Oxford.
Gwen Stacy, yeah.
And then he's trying to get into it too, or whatever. He's Spider-Maning around or whatever.
No, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, I just remember the very end of Amazing Spider-Man got pissed off all over again. But
But the point is, he's Tom Holland's Spider-Man or Peter Parker is a sophomore in high school. He's a wee baby Seamus.
The wee baby Seamus. Yeah, and this movie really leans into that too. Like that's kind of the thing. So those Andrew Garfield ones, they had high school as a backdrop, and the relationship between Peter Parker and Gwen Stacy played a huge part in those movies. But I feel those didn't really get into the community of high school in the same way as Spider-Man Homecoming does.
Yeah.
So Mike, overall, what were your thoughts on Spider-Man Homecoming?
I had a blast during this movie. I think, you know, your boy Toby is the perfect Spider-Man, or a more version or a better version in your opinion. I think Tom Holland, plays this kind of really good mix between, in our other reviews of Amazing Spider-Man, we talked about how Tobey Maguire is a great Peter Parker and, Andrew Garfield's a good Spider-Man.
Spider-Man.
He's an okay. I think I've come down. We've come down pretty hard on that now.
I really think Andrew Garfield, like I've talked about this in the past. I don't mean to just keep harping on the Amazing Spider-Man movies, because I really want to talk about Spider-Man Homecoming. But Andrew Garfield in the Amazing Spider-Man movies, I think is a terrible Peter Parker, because he's way too fucking cool and good looking.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You know, even before he has spider powers or anything like that, he is like clearly the most popular kid in school. Like, he's not Peter Parker, you know. Skateboarding through the halls. Gwen Stacy already likes him. Like, there's no there's nothing there. He's already sticking up for the little guy in his school. Like, it's lame. It's I mean, you know, he's like, Andrew Garfield's given a really good performance, I think, in those movies, because he's a great actor. I love Andrew Garfield. But I really think he's just miscast, because it's both a part of him being miscast and also the way that character is written. And then as Spider-Man, right, I think he just comes off as a dick. Like, that's kind of his
yeah, absolutely.
That's kind of the thing.
And I think Tom Holland manages to bridge the gap. I think, you know, Peter Parker. Tobey Maguire and Peter Parker are just so synonymous to me, Mike, now.
Yes. Tom Holland is Tobey Maguire.
Whatever. This is a long-winded way to say that. I think Tobey... goddammit. Look what you did to me, Mike.
Yep.
Tom Holland portrays a nerdy kind of losery, but still it's interesting now that, you know, nerd is the new cool. So like, they aren't these dorky little weird kids like his group of friends now. Right. But as Spider-Man, he is incredibly confident and sarcastic and in all the best ways that makes him not a dick. He's self-sacrificing. He does all that very believably to me. And like I said, I had a huge blast. I think Michael Keaton as the Vulture is really interesting, surprising for a Marvel villain. His great evil plot, it like kind of makes sense, and it isn't really a big great evil plot. and I think that's one of the things that I like the most about this movie is, I mentioned Ant-Man as a movie that I really like in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, because it's such small stakes. The stakes are very high, but it's just a small scale movie. What a pun.
Because
it's an Ant-Man movie. But they make the joke in Spider-Man Homecoming a couple times. Like, can't you just be a friendly neighborhood Spider-Man?
Right.
Like, you know, which is, I think, a fun joke. But like, the scale of the movie is so much about Queens and New York and just being a neighborhood superhero as compared to Thor, a literal god, right? I thought that was an interesting angle to take at the Marvel universe.
Yeah, no, I agree. And yeah, I think Spider-Man Homecoming is fun. I mean, it really is fun. I don't think the movie is as good as any of the Sam Raimi films, and I'm going to get a lot of flack for that because I am including Spider-Man 3.
Yeah, you are.
In that assessment. I do like Spider-Man 3 quite a bit. But I think it gets the character in a way that the Mark Webb movies just didn't. And that goes a long way. And I think you're right that Tom Holland has the best balance, I think, between what he's doing as Peter Parker versus what he's doing as Spider-Man, you know? And I think Tobey Maguire is my guy. And I think he's a great Peter Parker. And I think he's a great Spider-Man, too. But I think, in terms of what this movie's going for, I think Tom Holland really strikes the balance really well. And I think he's really good in the role, and I think he's only going to get better, is the thing. I think he's going to grow into the role with time. which, you know, I'm sure we're going to be seeing him as Spider-Man like once a year for the next 20 years. So,
oh yeah. Like he's going to be the next most bankable person forever.
That's the thing. I feel like this movie specifically positions him to kind of be the new face of the Marvel universe in a way. Cause Robert Downey Jr.'s contract is running out. It has been running out for years.
Yeah.
They keep extending it, but it can't last forever. And the conventional wisdom seems to be that, his, like, somehow he will be written out after Infinity War, or the fourth Avengers movie, or whatever that ends up being called.
Right.
And so, Tom Holland as Spider-Man could kind of be the new face of this universe, and we could see him. I think it would be really cool actually to see him grow up and grow into a new, like, Spider-Man over the course of several movies. So I think that's a great angle for this. And this movie pretty much picks up right where Civil War left off, with Peter Parker having met Tony Stark and been a part of the big airport battle, and then going back to New York and try to prove that he could be part of the Avengers. And I think that's an interesting angle to take, that, you know, he's not satisfied with just being a friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. He wants to be one of the top tier heroes. And it's somewhat meta take on what's the state of the Spider-Man franchise right now, who has, you know, he was once, you know, the cream, like the top of the line. Like when Spider-Man and Spider-Man 2 came out, like those movies were huge. Everybody went to go see those Spider-Man movies. And due to Sony's mishandling of the franchise, you know, less and less people have gone to see these Spider-Man movies. I think Amazing Spider-Man 2, really underperformed at the box office, and that's why we have this new Tom Holland Spider-Man in the Marvel Universe.
Right. So thanks for that, Sony.
Yeah. And so it's in a way like fighting, it's like almost like the Spider-Man franchise itself fighting for recognition once again. I think that's kind of an interesting take on it. So that's pretty cool. And yeah, we did mention this does place a greater emphasis on Peter Parker being in high school, which is it's a pretty intrinsic part of his character in the early Spider-Man comics. And especially in the Ultimate Spider-Man comics, because in the actual, like in the traditional Amazing Spider-Man comics, Peter Parker graduates high school, like 30 issues in, like,
right.
Like he's only in it for a couple of years and then he's gone. And then I think a lot of those comics he's in college, like that's kind of more of the time, but the Ultimate Spider-Man comics, the ones like the relaunch from 2000, I think he's in high school for like over 150 issues or something. Like it's a very long period of time. Wow. So, that is a pretty significant part of the character for a lot of people. And it takes a lot of its cues from John Hughes movies specifically, I think is where it's coming from.
You know, it's also right there in the title, right? It's Spider-Man Homecoming. It's a very high school event, the homecoming dance and all that stuff.
Yes.
And I think it's funny that you had mentioned, if the Amazing Spider-Man movies had been a romantic comedy with Spider-Man in the background, this is kind of just a high school movie with Spider-Man in the background.
I mean, I agree with that. I think I would have wanted that more. If I just like extend that like a little bit more, like, yes. Cause yeah, I think that's where this movie's greatest strength is the high school stuff. It builds like a really great community in that high school that feels very authentic. You know, it feels like a real high school. And the cast, you know, specifically, Jacob Batalon as Peter's best friend, Ned, Tony Revolori, as Flash Thompson, who Tony Revolori, the star of Grand Budapest Hotel.
Oh, that's where he's from. I knew that guy from somewhere. Yeah.
So super, super weird to see him in this super different role. And Martin Starr is the teacher. Are really great. Like those guys all do a lot of really great stuff. I do think virtually every female character in this movie is severely underwritten.
Yes.
Like there was a lot to like about Liz, for example, including the fact that she seemed to genuinely like Peter without knowing that he was Spider-Man. But it just felt like there should be more there. You know, it didn't seem like she had that much agency of her own.
No, not at all.
And Zendaya as Michelle, fantastic. Like
great.
Easily my favorite character in the movie, honestly. Like she's perfect. She gets maybe 15 lines of dialogue.
Yeah. She does a really great Ally Sheedy from Breakfast Club for most of the movie.
Yeah, which was the clear influence on that character. Mm-hmm. She has like 15 lines of dialogue total, and then there's a line at the end that's supposed to make it seem like she had a character arc when she clearly didn't.
And to definitely set up future arcs.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
just want to throw this out there. Ryan Gosling's daughter from The Nice Guys and Gory Rice played Betty Brandt, and that was neat.
That was hilarious. That just, man, I'm sure you've seen the Boom Goes the Dynamite YouTube video from like 2009. You don't know what that is?
I don't know.
Oh man, there's an old YouTube clip from when it first came out of a high school morning morning news like guy doing the sports, like sports recap
okay.
for the basketball game. And he keeps just stumbling over himself and he can't get the like call out, except anytime someone hits a basket, the only complete sentence he gets is, and boom goes the dynamite. And he like just keeps trying to stutter his way to the next basket
okay.
where he says, and boom goes the dynamite. And it's hilarious. And that reminded me of the morning newscasters who keep like the green screen keeps flashing and yes. they miscue each other. It's great.
Yeah, I did love that. That whole like, you know, it felt like a very like authentic high school newscast, and it was pretty great.
Yeah.
And yeah, we should talk about Michael Keaton a little bit as the film's villain, the Vulture, Adrian Toomes, which partially I like that they use the Vulture because he hasn't been used in a Spider-Man movie before. And yeah. Spider-Man has such a wide range of villains too that you don't need to do the Green Goblin over and over again. You know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, he feels like a kind of, I mean, I don't know in terms of the grand overall Spider-Man lore, but Vulture feels like a significant but kind of smaller villain in terms, like, you know, Green Goblin, like you just mentioned, in Venom, or the huge, everyone knows who they are.
Pretty huge, yeah.
It feels like Vulture is significant in that it's kind of, is it maybe typically Spider-Man's first villain that he comes across?
One of the first, yeah. I think it's, there's Amazing Fantasy 15, and then I guess
it's Lizard is the other first one, usually, maybe.
Lizard's among the first. Yeah, I think yeah. Vulture might actually be the first one, issue number one. But yeah, no, the Vulture is a pretty well-known Spider-Man villain. He's been in a lot of stuff. He's in many versions, he's a member of the Sinister Six and all that stuff. He's one of those guys who's always, you know, out to get Spider-Man. But the interesting thing about this is that, you know, the Vulture is usually portrayed as this, like, octogenarian, you know, 80-year-old man in, like, this colorful winged bird suit. whereas in this movie, it's Michael Keaton, who is not 80 years old. Actually, originally, like, when Sam Raimi's Spider-Man 4 that we never saw, John Malkovich was supposed to play the Vulture. That was the
right.
thing. And that would have been insane. That would have been crazy. but Michael Keaton gives a great performance as the Vulture, I think. But to me, I just felt like he was like one or two scenes short of being like a really fully fleshed out character. I feel like it was like almost there. I feel like a lot of bits about this movie, I was like, it's like almost there, but like not quite for me. Again, I really enjoyed the movie. Like, I had a lot of fun with it. But I feel like I had a lot of criticisms about it too. And and so it's going to sound like I hated it, but I didn't. I really enjoyed the movie.
That's good.
So I just wanted to throw that out there because I'm going to tear it apart.
But it comes from a place of love.
It comes from a place of love because I love Spider-Man so much, man. So the Vulture, you know, I really enjoy Michael Keaton's performance as the character. I really was not a fan of the look of the Vulture. I feel like his costume just kind of became a mess of CGI that was very unmemorable and, like, lacking any visual impact for me. But I don't know. What did you think of the Vulture? Because I feel like they do try to do some interesting stuff with his character.
Yeah, I think it's kind of cool. I was shocked, or not shocked, that's a strong word, but like when it opens in the cleanup aftermath of the Avengers city battle, the Chitauri, right?
Yes, Chitauri.
Big battle, and they're kind of a salvage crew, and they kind of, the blue-collar guy gets screwed by the government regulation kind of thing. So, like, that, I thought that was a kind of interesting take. I don't know the Vulture's, canonical backstory, like I mentioned. So I thought that was an interesting way to kind of to spur someone into this life of crime. And I kind of like that they were, like, a kind of gritty heist crew. Bokeem Woodbine is awesome.
Yeah.
I liked the look of the Vulture's costume without the wings, right? The, like, weird bomber fighter jacket and the fighter pilot helmet and mask he's wearing looks really cool. I think it does eventually in the big climax fight become a bizarre set of CG wings. But for the earlier stuff, it looks pretty cool. I was on board. Didn't look anything too outrageous compared to everything else that's going on in this world. For the most part, not in this movie though. I think that might hinder it. This movie, like we mentioned, is very small scale. Like the first fight is him with some ATM robbers with Halloween masks on, right? So to compare that to the big CGI wings and mess that is the Vulture, definitely might hurt that look a little bit.
Maybe.
But I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think visually, the movie kind of falls flat when it comes to most of its action scenes, and that's part of what hampers it for me. And like I can't rate it on the same scale as the Sam Raimi movies. The Sam Raimi movies, like, as some of the best superhero action that has ever existed. I just feel like there's not that much going on in terms of like really inventive and creative action. I think the CGI does look kind of weightless. I think the strongest sequence is probably the Washington Monument sequence. In the movie, I think that's a really fun sequence, but I think it does really hurt the movie in its climax, and the climax is kind of very underwhelming. And it kind of it reminded me of a different climax from another superhero movie that I'll talk about in spoilers. It just kind of felt like a very dark, like nothing kind of like didn't really feel like there was much going on there. I did want to say something that has been bugging me a little bit, right? So. Much has been said of this film, like not being an origin story for Spider-Man, right? And it's not. And I think that's a great thing. You know, I think that's a really great angle to take it because, we've seen the Spider-Man origin story a couple of times at this point. Everyone already knows it. But it kind of is also a Spider-Man origin story in a way. It's kind of about Peter Parker becoming Spider-Man in spirit.
Right.
If not necessarily in abilities. That said, I think the movie seems to go out of its way to avoid any talk of Spider-Man's origins, specifically Uncle Ben, which I think is kind of a mistake. I don't know. How did you feel about that?
I definitely noticed it. We get an explanation of where Peter's powers come from. So like we get that kind of lip service exposition version of it. But like you said, everyone knows the origin story already. It definitely, the lack of Uncle Ben definitely removes the emotional punch of the hero's journey to become, or Peter's journey to become Spider-Man in spirit or however you phrased it. But I don't know if I necessarily need it. I don't know. I don't know how to feel about this. I did notice that there's no discussion of it. We have that mention, or we have that hint towards Uncle Ben in Civil War, but we don't have anything in this.
Right. They do it. There's like a line where I think he's talking to his friend Ned, and he asks like, "Why don't you reveal to Aunt May who you are?" And she's like, "No, she would hate this. You know, after everything she's been through, something like that is what he says."
Yeah.
And so presumably that's about Uncle Ben, but that could be about anything. That could be about like the bad lunch that she ate the day before or something. It's probably about Uncle Ben, but like but to me, I feel like what this movie does is it really tries to focus on just being a very fun Spider movie. And to that end, I think it succeeds. Again, I think it's a very fun movie. It's very funny. It's very quippy. It's, you know, it's very light. But also, like, Peter's guilt over Uncle Ben's death is kind of what drives him to become the person he is, because he's partially responsible for Uncle Ben's death.
Right.
And so, you know, we don't have to beat the audience over the head with that because we already know it. And Raimi's movies did that all the time. But, it felt like we should acknowledge it in some way. You know, it felt like there should be at least like lip service paid to the fact that like Uncle Ben had some effect emotionally on Peter, that he might still be grieving over Uncle Ben's death. Because I think in Civil War they established that like it happened like 6 months ago, something like that. Or he had been Spider-Man for about 6 months.
Yeah. And
so presumably, if he had been Spider-Man for about 6 months, then that's about the amount of time that had passed since Uncle Ben died.
Right, and I think that's the line. That's the moment where he says like if people like me don't stand up, good people get hurt or something. Right. That kind of like nods to what happened to Uncle Ben, but we never have a explicit conversation.
Right. I think what might have helped is if Aunt May had been in more of the movie, but Marissa Tomei is really not given much to do.
Yeah.
Again, another really underwritten female character in this movie. So that might have helped it out, I think. And, you know, if we saw maybe her struggle a little bit, like that would be pretty good. That said, Marissa Tomei is good when she's in the movie.
All we need is her looking forlornly at a photograph on the mantelpiece of her and Uncle Ben, and like, that's enough.
That would have been good.
Like, that
would have been fine. Just pay a little lip service to it.
And, yeah.
You know, nothing could have been worse than what they did in Amazing Spider-Man. Do you remember what they did in that movie?
He dies over chocolate milk,
yes.
Right? Yeah.
Peter lets Uncle Ben die over chocolate milk. It was ridiculous.
Tell us how you really feel.
Oh,
like.
Man. Those movies, man. Those movies. Anyway, and so we should talk about some of the larger Marvel Cinematic Universe stuff. It's fun. You know, I think it's a lot of fun. And, you know, that's part of what we like about these movies is that they can kind of just throw you in and out, like have characters pop up from here and there. And it totally makes sense. And it's just totally cool. And it's always cool to see Robert Downey Jr.'s Iron Man. You know, he's good. And it's much more of a supporting role than the marketing would have you believe, I think. You know, he's really only in like a few scenes throughout the movie. And I think he and Peter have a really good dynamic, which arguably speaks more to Tony's arc throughout these movies than Peter's. You know, I feel like I feel like we've seen so much character growth with Tony Stark over since 2008. It's kind of nuts.
Yeah.
Like, who would have thought that the arrogant genius billionaire playboy philanthropist, you know, we met 9 years ago would ever be the mentor to this young kid? You know.
Yeah, and they say that, they call that out a couple times where he in his conversations to, you know, to Peter about his protecting himself, and if anything gets hurt, you get hurt, whatever, if you're not, no, you're nothing without the suit, you don't deserve it, and all that stuff. But he mentions a couple times that, you know, oh man, I sound like my dad, or I can't believe how much I am my father, or whatever. You know, they reference his character arc that's spanned 16 movies, which is fucking crazy.
It's bananas. But again, just to me, Spider-Man is who he is because he doesn't have access to, you know, a billionaire's technology at a moment's notice, right? He's just some kid who only has what he can create himself, and he's a genius, mm-hmm. so he can create those things. So I feel like to essentially hand him all these tools that he uses throughout the movie, it's really cool and funny, like, in the moment, but I think it like, does kind of betray what I feel like the character is a little bit. But that said, like, that's a minor thing. I enjoyed the movie. I enjoyed all the fun tools and stuff that he had throughout. So there was that.
I think there's a, for me, you know, I don't have as close a emotional tie to this character. But I felt like there was enough of a balance between those two things, where it's Peter's ingenuity versus Tony Stark's suit or his crazy tech.
Right.
I think we get enough just things that I wasn't worried about that. Like, we see him making the web fluid in chemistry class secretly in the drawer or whatever, and a couple other things with the calculator. some crazy stuff happening. But yeah, I thought maybe that's spoiler things. I don't know. We could talk about it in spoilers.
Yeah, I mean, I do. Yeah, there is some stuff in, regarding that in spoilers that I will talk about. But yeah, anyway, to me, this did feel like the most, like, by committee Marvel movie in a while. Like, it didn't really feel like it had, like, as much of a directorial mm-hmm. voice as some of the other ones that they've recently had. And I think that's a result of a couple things. You know, it's too many cooks in the kitchen, possibly. There's two different studios and six screenwriters working on this movie. So there's a lot of voices going in there. I just felt like I never got, like, a firm grasp on John Watts' directorial voice, which is a bummer because I loved his previous movie, Cop Car, with Kevin Bacon. That was a great, great movie. And I think he was hired off of that movie because of how well he captured the relationships between the kids in that movie. This movie does that incredibly well. So to that end, you know, that's cool. So hopefully I think he'll have more of a say in Spider-Man Winter Formal or whatever.
God damn it.
Spider-Man Prom, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there's only so many places we can go.
Yeah.
But I think I cut you off earlier when we were talking about the John Hughes high school movie influences, the direct call out that happens in the suburb sequence.
Yes, yeah.
I don't know if that's spoilers or not. I don't know. I think it's more of a Easter egg kind of thing.
Yeah, but no, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, and that was a fun little throwaway gag and stuff. Like, that was cool. I really did enjoy that sequence. Actually, that was a fun sequence. also, I just want to throw this out there. Almost every minor role in this movie is filled by somebody that I love. It's kind of insane. Donald Glover is in this movie.
Sure.
Which is great. So that was cool. Martin Starr, Kenneth Choi is the principal. And actually, he was one of the Howling Commandos in Captain America, the First Avenger.
Yes.
And in this movie, he's playing the descendant of that character. And you actually see, like, there's a picture of his grandfather in, like, the Howling Commandos in his office.
Right.
Which is kind of neat. Michael Mando from Better Call Saul, who plays Nacho on Better Call Saul, appears in this movie as well. That's pretty cool. Hannibal Buress is in this movie as the gym teacher. Bokeem Woodbine, we mentioned before, from Fargo, plays the Shocker. And Martha Kelly from Baskets appears as a tour guide. Also, Jennifer Connelly plays Karen, the voice in Spider-Man's suit. And she's also married to Paul Bettany, who played Jarvis in Iron Man's suit, which is a fun little thing that's Kevin Feige's been talking about a lot in the interviews there. So there's that. For me, it's like a pretty, like, middle-tier Marvel Universe movie for me. But, you know, even the lowest of the lower-tier Marvel movies, they've never been, like, outright bad, you know? And I think their worst movie is probably Iron Man 2. And even that has its moments. And this movie does a lot of things really well. And the things it sets up for the future are really promising. I think the sequel to this movie will probably be great. And that's kind of this.
Yeah.
I feel like it's kind of how it goes with the superhero movies too. It's like, you know, you have this first movie that kind of sets up everything, and then the sequel is where it really shines. And that was
the Ouija 2 effect.
It's the Ouija 2 effect. That is a callback to my love for Ouija 2 from last week, listeners. But yeah, no, I mean, you know, you got Winter Soldier was like a huge improvement over First Avenger and X-Men 2 and the original Spider-Man 2. And, you know, I feel the sequel for superhero movies in a lot of cases is almost always better, which, you know, is bodes well for Spider-Man Homecoming Dose or Spider-Man 2 Home. Spider-Man 2 Home 2 Coming. I don't know.
Oh man, that was such a great thing to watch you try to get through. I'm excited though. I of course, you know, as every new original origin in the origin might not be the best word, but you know, the introduction movie, solo introduction movie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, I am of course the most excited for the large ensemble movies to watch them interact with even more of the Avengers and main cast. Because even his small glimpse in Civil War with the full cast was so much fun. And
absolutely.
Now that we have more of him, I don't know. I'm just in.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm in. I think I'm pretty much in for whatever Marvel does at this point.
Like,
I'm,
yeah. You? I'm shocked.
Yeah, I'm not going to be like, I'm not going to see this Marvel movie. Obviously, I'm going to see this Marvel movie. Actually, I should throw this out there. This has nothing to do with the quality of the movie or anything. As the movie was ended and we were all leaving the theater, there's this group of people behind us, these two dudes. One of them was like, oh, yeah. And he was like talking like he knew everything about everything. He clearly had no idea what the, like, he clearly knew nothing about anything. He was like, oh, I wonder which one of Kevin Feige's underlings was responsible for this or whatever. And then he started getting like visibly pissed off that he still had to go to these movies. And I'm like, you don't have to go. Like, he was acting like he's like a comic book purist or whatever, who is too good for these movies, but is still going to see them anyway.
Of course.
And like, fuck you, man. And so he was saying, like, once Avengers Infinity War 2 comes out, then I'm done. I'm done with the whole thing. And I'm like, all right, fuck it, stop now. Why do you care if you hate them so much? But then the best part was, as we were leaving, he was like, yeah, I wonder who was responsible for, you know, scheduling Ant-Man and the Wasp after Avengers Infinity War. Like, you're going to do the biggest, most crazy blockbustery thing that we've ever seen up to this point, and then follow it up with Ant-Man. Like, what? And then he started talking about how this is true. He started talking about how if Marvel had the balls, they would go with, you know, an R-rated Ant-Man movie. That's the one that I
what?
He started talking about how he wanted like an R-rated Ant-Man movie and started adapting this like crazy dark Ant-Man story or something. And I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Look, Mike, he hates these movies, but he's only gonna invest 15 years and 25 movies. That's all he's in for.
He's only in for at least $250 worth of movie tickets.
Yeah, that's it.
Anyway, so yeah, I think we should get into spoilers for Spider-Man Homecoming. I'm amazed we haven't done that yet. We have to wrap up this podcast at some point.
But first, boom goes the dynamite on that guy.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, let's move on into spoilers for Spider-Man Homecoming, starting right now. All right, spoilers for Spider-Man Homecoming, starting right now. So, hey, Mike, this week I watched a superhero film in which the final fight took place at night in a deserted wasteland surrounded by flames and cardboard boxes that involved a villain decked out in CGI armor and an exploding airplane. But enough about Wonder Woman, Mike.
There
it
is. We've
got to talk about Spider-Man Homecoming.
And boom goes the dynamite.
Boom goes the dynamite. There it is. This is a very eerily similar climax, I thought. Like, it's
just, it was.
Very odd. And I remember talking about in my Wonder Woman review how I was kind of underwhelmed by the climax of that movie. I was kind of underwhelmed by the climax here. Just visually, like, they're just kind of flat for me.
Yeah, I hadn't even considered it as the same thing until you started alluding to the fact that you were going to mention it during spoilers, and I was like, oh shit, it's the same thing as Wonder Woman. Because I feel like the climax to this, to me, is the fight on the plane and the kind of plane crash explodey, we're just surrounded by fire yelling at each other thing on the beach, is kind of just the end. Like, I don't feel like, I mean, I think literally nothing happens there. Which I thought the stuff on the plane, on the outside of the plane with the flashing lights and the light, you know, the cloaking stuff is turning on and off, visually looked really cool. It made it kind of hard to follow though.
Yeah, that was the thing. Like, all of that just kind of felt like a blur to me. Like, I was,
yeah.
You know, But, yeah, whatever. I did like that Spider-Man had essentially lost the final fight with the Vulture.
Yeah.
Like, he was going to lose that fight. And that he was... And that the only reason he got the Vulture was because he was trying to save his life as he was flying away. Yeah. Which I think really emphasizes, you know, one, that, yes, he's just a kid. You know, he doesn't have a ton of battle experience yet.
Right.
And two, he's just a really good person who's not going to kill as a means to an end, which I think sets him apart from Tony Stark as well.
Yeah, I mean, that happens. That's a recurring joke earlier in the film when he takes off the training wheel protocol and
his suit has a lethal mode or something, right?
Yeah, instant kill mode keeps trying to turn on, which Tony Stark built his suit for him. But yeah, I think that also too, that scene also kind of hints at Tombs, the Vulture, as like a redeemable character in some way. Like he chooses not to kill Peter multiple times.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And the post-credit scene kind of emphasizes that too. And I'll talk about that in a minute. I did want to talk about the movie's twist that the Vulture is Liz's dad, which Peter discovers while taking Liz to Homecoming. You know, so I think that works pretty well in the moment if you can buy into it. I think it's a little far-fetched. Just because there's, like, you know, millions of people in New York City. That's a huge coincidence.
It's a pretty small city, Mike.
Yeah. I guess it is a small city, but it is very densely populated.
Well played.
Some of those people aren't even vultures, you know? Some of them are just
Yeah, whatever happened to truth in advertising, you know?
But it definitely elicited some gasps in my theater. You know, people were surprised by it. And I think it also results directly in Michael Keaton's best scene when he's threatening Peter in the car. I think that was, like, easily Keaton's best moment of the movie. And as a Spider-Man fan, a spider fan, if you will, I had this giddy moment of recognition in the movie when I realized they were about to recreate the iconic scene from Amazing Spider-Man number 33. In which,
who could forget?
Well, that it. If you're a Spider-Man fan,
I'm kidding.
Which is when Spider-Man is crushed under a bunch of rubble, and he's stuck, and he's, you know, in despair, and it's like his last thread of you know, of humanity, and he wills himself to push it back up, and that is a huge scene for Spider-Man fans. That is the kind of moment where he becomes the Spider-Man that we all know and love in the comics. Like, that's really it right there. And I think the movie utilizes it to the same effects, and I think Tom Holland plays it really well. I think what makes it effective is that it's very rare to see our superheroes in that vulnerable state.
Yeah.
He's like crying in that scene, right? Like, he's like tearing.
Yeah, he gives up for a while.
Yeah, and it kind of emphasizes that, like, oh, he's just a kid. Like, he's just this 15-year-old. He has no idea what he's doing. He's, like, way out of his league. But he's persistent, and he's going to keep trying anyway. And I think that's a very powerful moment for this movie. It's probably the best sequence in the movie, quite frankly, now that I'm talking about it.
I do think that having Spider-Man Peter Parker be so young, to be sort of in the middle of his high school career and not the senior, like, you know, in the other ones we talked about, he graduates in the beginning of the first movie. To have that opportunity, like you said, to have our hero still be incredibly vulnerable and so inexperienced at what he's trying to do. It gives the opportunity for interesting things like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where instead of being the literal God of Thunder or the Hulk.
Yeah. And I do want to mention, so you mentioned the line before when after the whole boat scene where Tony saves Spider-Man and, like, they're having an argument. And Tony asks for the suit back. Spider-Man says, I'm nothing without the suit. Tony says to him, if you're nothing without the suit, then you shouldn't have it. I think that is a great line from Tony Stark because it also illustrates the road that he's taken throughout all these movies. And we mentioned that before. But specifically, and I think the Marvel movies have been really good at doing this. It's a very subtle callback to the line from the Avengers where he's arguing with Captain America. And Captain America asks him, like, big man in a suit of armor, take that away. And what are you? And, you know, Tony, like, comes back with a sarcastic answer, like, genius billionaire playboy philanthropist, but you can tell it, like, does get to him. And so I think that's, like, the fact that, like, you know, we've watched Tony over the past few years. You know, we saw in Iron Man 3 and Avengers 2 and Captain America Civil War, like, we saw that character evolve over time to the point where he is at the point where he's like, yeah, if you're nothing without the suit, then you shouldn't have the suit. Like, that's, I think that's a very powerful statement on where Tony's character is at. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think that attempts to serve the with great power comes great responsibility role in this film.
It does kind of fit the same line, thing, yeah.
But I think it's much more impactful as a Tony Stark moment instead of a Spider-Man moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, I do want to throw this out there that Tony Stark and Pepper Potts are apparently back together again, which is nice to see.
I did like that joke call out that Happy's been carrying the ring since 2008. That was really funny.
That was pretty good. So that was pretty cool. Gwyneth Paltrow pops up for one scene in the movie, and it's actually, if you watch the credits of the movie, Gwyneth Paltrow was like fourth billed, which is like how much did her agent? How much did her agent have to fight to get that to happen? But
before even Robert Downey Jr. has Gwyneth Paltrow.
Well, I think Robert Downey Jr. gets the like and credit at the end. So that supersedes everything. There's a very complex relationship with end credits, Mike. You got to understand.
Sure. Yeah.
Also, Jon Favreau as Happy probably gets more to do in this movie than in any of the Iron Man movies. Except unless you count directing them.
Apples and oranges.
And I think he actually like really effectively sells like Happy's desperation for his job. Also the inadequacy that he kind of feels being in the Stark shadow all the time. I think that comes to play here. That came into play a little bit in Iron Man 3, but I think that comes across more here, too.
I was going to say, I wonder if the press conference backdrop to that scene where Stark asks Peter to accept the new suit and become part of the Avengers officially and stuff, I wonder if that is the reference to when Peter, like in Civil War kind of thing, where he unmasks himself.
I think that was kind of the idea, yeah. So we don't know what would happen in the press conference. Like, it would have just been like Spider-Man in a mask. But if Spider-Man had joined the Avengers, he would probably have had to sign the Sokovia Accords from Civil War, in which case he would have had to reveal his identity, I would imagine.
Right.
So that would be part of that as well. Anyway, I also wanted to say, if Zendaya had more to do throughout the movie, I think the reveal at the end that her friends call her MJ might have landed better. I mean, I think as is, it's fine. You know, it's very clearly set up for the next movie. But it reminded me of the end of The Dark Knight Rises when Joseph Gordon-Levitt walks up to the lady and she's like, "Oh, you should go by your first name, Robin."
Wink to the camera.
Yeah.
It's like okay enough. I thought, you know, her character and just that, you know, I'm not obsessed. I'm just very observant. She's funny when her 15 lines are pretty good or whatever she does.
Yeah. Like I think she's the best character in the movie. And if she had more to do, it'd be great. I'm assuming it's setting her up to be in more of Spider-Man 2 or whatever. But
right. I thought it was going to build up to the fact that she approaches Peter and tells him that she knows that he's Spider-Man, because it certainly seems that way. She's always observant. She's in the background of a lot of scenes. She's kind of watching him all the time.
That's true.
It seems like she's aware that or at least is hiding something, is maybe Spider-Man. But then, my friends call me MJ. Sure. That's cool.
Yeah, I mean, and here's the thing. I had kind of assumed going in that she would probably end up being MJ, because there was a lot of big deal around her character. And Marvel was being very careful. Like, oh, no, her name is Michelle, and like whatever. But what Kevin Feige is saying is that she's not Mary Jane Watson. They're calling her MJ to kind of remind you of that dynamic. And so I think that's interesting. So it's kind of like it's like a new interpretation of what MJ can be.
Right.
So I think that's cool. I mean, I don't really, like, if she was Mary Jane Watson, that'd be fine. I don't really care.
Yeah, I assume she'll be the girlfriend the love interest.
Presumably, yeah. And I think, like, I think that's, just based on her characterization in this movie, I love this version of MJ. Like, what MJ represents. I think that's a great version, and I think it's really cool. So I'm eager to see more of Zendaya in that role, because I think that's pretty neat there.
I do want to applaud the group. I mean, we've talked about it before, the group of friends, the debate team or whatever. Just like profoundly diverse in like the best, coolest ways.
Oh yeah.
Flash is not Joe Manganiello or whatever his name is from Spider-Man, the original, the Sam Raimi ones. He's not this giant buff bully. He's just like a rich kid that's a dick. I don't know. I don't know. Like, he fulfills a good bully role without being the stereotypical bully.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about this movie is I think they kind of changed the high school setting so that it's more like a magnet school for science kids kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it's like a science and technology school.
Right. And so you have like a different kind of group of kids. But yeah, it's like Flash is like your rich douchebag. And, you know, the other ones, there are other kids there as well.
Liz and MJ are not white and blonde. Ned is one of my favorite characters of the whole movie, I think.
Yeah, he's really good.
The scene when he finally gets to be the man in the chair, like,
yes,
glorious. That's it was so much fun.
That was one of the best laughs in the movie when somebody discovers him in the chair and he's like, what are you doing in here? And he's just like staring at them for a second. And he's like, I'm watching porn.
It's amazing.
Which was pretty good. Also recalls a pretty great Simpsons joke. I won't go into that.
When would you ever pass up the opportunity? Oh, you're right. We've already gone 2 hours.
We've already gone for so long, and I still have so much to talk about. I did want to talk about the post-credit scenes in this movie.
Yeah.
Because we always have to. The first one is kind of the major one. There's two of them. Mm-hmm. The first one's the major one. It's Michael Mando reappears. He's playing Mac Gargan, who is Scorpion in the Spider-Man comics. That's why he has the Scorpion tattoo on his neck, and he points to it as if to make sure everybody knows, hey, I'm Scorpion.
Scorpion.
And he's in jail with the Vulture, and he's trying to get their Vulture to reveal who Spider-Man is, because rumor has it that he knows who Spider-Man is. And he asks him if he wants to join up with some other dude to want to kill Spidey, implying Sinister Six. And Vulture does not. And I like that about that. Like we said, like it kind of like shows that the Vulture might be like a redeemable character.
I think he says, if I knew who he was, don't you think he'd be dead already, or something like that.
So hopefully, I'm hoping that we see more of Michael Keaton in the future. I think his newfound debt to Spider-Man for saving both his life and his daughter's life could be something really cool to explore in future movies. So that's cool. And then also, Chris Evans has a cameo for his second post-credit scene as Captain America. This happens throughout the movie for several PSA videos. These are the best scenes in the movie. I said before that the heartwarming sequence for Spider-Man lifts up the rubble is the best scene in the movie. It's not. It's these silly post-credits. It's these silly PSA videos with Captain America.
And Hannibal Buress.
I love the idea that, like, Captain America, after he got unfrozen, agreed to being like, yeah, I'll do these PSA videos.
Of course he would.
Because he absolutely would. It's the best.
That idea that it's the Captain America fitness test instead of the presidential fitness test you have to do in high school. Like, of course it is. Yeah. That's perfect.
Why not? He does a couple. I think there's, like, three of them you see throughout the movie. There's, like, two during the movie and one in the post-credits. They're the best thing in the world. I hope there's a half hour's worth of them on the special features of the Blu-ray. And I also love, like, during the first one, he's talking about, like, the Captain America fitness test, and he's like, and you're gonna need help from your gym teacher, and he, like, points to the side of the TV, but it's the opposite side that Hannibal Buress is standing on.
Yeah.
And Hannibal Buress says something like, yeah, I think this dude's, like, a war criminal now or something, but, like, whatever.
He just blows a whistle. I love that Hannibal Buress also, maybe a tiny bit of film news, sent a body double to the premiere. I don't know if you saw that.
I think I did see that, actually. Yeah.
He, like, tweeted about it. Was like, hey, anyone want to go to the premiere instead of me? And he, like, just sent a guy, like, a different person. But, yeah, I loved that post-credit scene with Captain America talking about the virtues of patience and how sometimes it's not always worth it. It doesn't always pay off.
Yes.
Which was a great, like, as soon as it started, I was like, oh yeah, we have directly called out Ferris Bueller. Of course this is the last scene of the movie is just this dumb thing talking to the camera. Like, it's great.
Yeah. Which is kind of weird because Deadpool had the exact same post-credit scene.
Well, yeah, the exact same post-credit scene.
Yeah. I mean, the exact one as Ferris Bueller.
That's, yeah.
Yeah. I did love those Captain America PSAs. That was great. And then also Donald Glover's scene with Spidey in interrogation mode is also pretty great.
I forgot about the voice.
Yeah, and it's a pretty funny dig at Batman, which I really enjoyed. And also, I should note that Donald Glover is playing Aaron Davis, who is Prowler in the Spider-Man comics. And they show his code name as Prowler on, like, the screen when Spider-Man's, like, looking at him on stuff. Yeah, but he also mentions his nephew, that he has a nephew living in Queens. His nephew is Miles Morales.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so...
That's hot. That's real hot.
Yeah, so they threw that in there for the people. And so now it's established, like, Aaron Davis is in the universe, and he has a nephew, and that nephew is probably Miles Morales. So,
yeah.
I really think, like, they'll keep Tom Holland as long as they can, probably for the next 10, 15 years. And then once he's finally finished playing Spider-Man, they're going to bring in Miles Morales and just keep the thing going.
I was wondering if they're going to, you mentioned earlier that Robert Downey Jr. is towards the end of his contract, probably, after Infinity War 2.
Yeah.
I wonder if they will usher out Iron Man or if he will pass the suit on to, what's the character's name in the comic books currently? Riri, I think?
I would imagine probably not that character since she's not in the movies yet.
Yeah.
like at this point, like presumably Iron Man will be in Infinity War and Avengers 4, and that's it. So I feel like there's going to be so many characters in that in those movies, you're not going to have time to introduce a brand new person to take over Iron Man.
Right. Well, they'll just pull what they did for this, where they just kind of confirmed a fan theory about Iron Man 2, I think, or 1.
Oh, yeah. That's
the little kid that stands in front of the robots or whatever. Yeah, I can't remember
that
exactly.
Okay, so there's been a long-standing fan theory that in Iron Man 2, there's a little kid in an Iron Man mask at Tony Stark's like science expo who Tony Stark saves from one of the robots that is running around. And a long-standing fan theory is that was Peter Parker. And that's been the case like since Iron Man 2 came out. And Marvel has never said anything about it until like just now. They're like, oh yeah, that's Peter Parker. And that's totally easy. That's so easy for them to say because it's like, yeah, why not?
Yeah, I mean, sure.
Sure.
We'll retcon that.
We don't have to actually do anything. You'll just accept it and it'll be fine.
Yeah, they could just do that for any of the other children. I don't know. I'm sure at some point another kid will stand in front of a monster stand up to them and be saved.
And that'll be Riri Williams from Iron Man. Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, one last thing about Spider-Man Homecoming. Best smash cut to credits. Long time. Loved it. Loved that so much. That was the best one since like Killing Them Softly. You remember that?
Yeah.
Killing Them Softly was a great one. The World's End is another great one. That Game of Thrones episode where Jamie gets his hand chopped off is a great one.
right.
This one is like up there in terms of like the recent smash cuts to credits. I loved it so much.
I also do appreciate that the end credits are kind of like this weird 60s pop art, which is a nice throwback to the origins of Spider-Man.
Yeah, Marvel's actually, to their credit, they've always done a really good job with their end credits.
Yeah,
they usually have like really creative like end credits, so it makes the wait for the post credits scenes not so bad. but like Guardians of the Galaxy 2 had, you know, all the crazy shit happening throughout the credits,
all the dancing and stuff,
and stuff like that, and you know, a lot of stuff happening. But anyway, yeah. So I think that finally wraps up our review.
I've got 20 more minutes on Twin Peaks episode 8, though, Mike.
Oh well, we have to get into those. but in any case, yes, this movie does good by Spider-Man, and you know, it keeps the adventure pretty light, pretty fun. Even if I would have liked a little more gravitas and a little more directorial vision, I did like the movie, you know, and we'll obviously watch all of them as they keep coming. Yep. I'm not going to lie about it. It doesn't live up to Sam Raimi's take on Spider-Man, but then again, very few things could, you know.
Who could?
So, Mike, you kind of in the same boat?
Yeah. I think I had a little more fun. I mean, not that you didn't have fun,
it seemed like you were higher on the movie than I was. To me, I even like I went through my Marvel Cinematic Universe rankings. I think it's like in my bottom four of Marvel movies of the 16 that exist. And even then, like again, I had fun with it. Like it's a lot of fun. So
I think I had a good time. I think Tom Holland has a very promising and bright future as the most handsome human on Earth after somebody else. I don't know.
As a slave to the Marvel machine. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. I can't wait to see him with a evil guy goatee like Robert Downey Jr. It'll be great.
Yeah. I hope that's what they do instead of the black suit. He just grows a goatee.
The Darkest Timeline.
The Darkest Timeline Spider-Man. I love it. Yeah. All right, Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all of my podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com, plus some of my work at crookedscoreboard.com. You can find it there as well. Thank you so much for listening to Filmbookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That is Mike DiCriccio. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, you can subscribe to the podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones, hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Now join us for the next episode of Film Bookcast in 2 weeks, where we're either going to be discussing War for the Planet of the Apes or Dunkirk, maybe both. We'll see.
Who knows?
We'll see what happens. It's all tossed up in the air. It's crazy pants. It's crazy town banana pants. And you can check out our next complete works, where we're going to be talking Nicolas Cage's role in 2004's National Treasure. Very, very excited about that one, Mike. We'll finally get to that one next. Thank you so much for listening, guys. We are out. In the chills of the night.